You're listening to Truth Quest Radio, or Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio 106.9, Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And KHEN is streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info, or link from the khen.org website. And if you would like to send an email into the program for questions with our guests, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And we're going to have a brief song here with Poker Face while I get set up for my guest William Roberts and Don Parmeter. We're going to be talking about Agenda 21 and the Senate Bill 787, which has to do with federalizing water. And coming up next, and my co-host will be Shannon Hemingway.
And the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
Hey, Mr. Politician, living on that hill. Living in that life of luxury on We the People's Bill. Don't have a clue how the other half lives, and that is a shame. It's time to stop the tyranny you keep pushing through your bills. Calling for revolution. Save our Constitution while we still got the guns in our hands. And there's a farmer who's starving on their land. The rancher tries to feed his cattle and sheep on We the People's land. Try and live as a free man. Your body is illegal, let him home. Time to stop these thugs from stealing what's been got in their town. Calling for revolution. Calling for it now. It's time to save our Constitution while we still got the guns in our hands. Now is the time to turn back the clock of a tyranny. For if we don't, then who will do it for ourselves? And how about our children? What kind of future will we leave them? And if we won't, we'll wake up slaves on the global plantation. Calling for a revolution. Calling for it now. It's time to save our Constitution while we still got the guns in our hands. Calling for a revolution. Calling for it now. It's time to save our Constitution while we still got the guns in our hands. While we still got the guns. Still got the guns in our hands.
Again, this is Truth Quest with Melody. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I wanted to briefly hit a public service announcement and Summer is hot, and so is Cahen at 106.9. We're having our summer membership drive for 2 weeks from June 12th to June 26th. Any new or renewing Cahen membership at any level will get a two-for-one pass for a soak at Mount Princeton Hot Springs Resort. And any membership at the $50 level will get your choice of either a great Cahen short sleeves t-shirt or a reusable canvas shopping bag or a Cahen sampler CD. At the $100 membership level, you'll get a choice of any two t-shirt canvas bags or a Cahen sampler CD. We also have two very special offers for those with the $250 memberships. Package one, a two-for-one coupon at Mount Princeton Hot Springs and two Cahen t-shirts and a reusable canvas bag and a certificate for a one-night stay at Mount Princeton's Hot Springs Resort. And package two, a two-for-one coupon at Mount Princeton's Hot Springs and two Cahen t-shirts and a reusable canvas bag and 10 visit pass to Mount Princeton Hot Springs Resort. Help support community radio with your membership contribution today. You can keep us clucking on with a little or a lot. Go now for our website at khen.org and click on the membership link. Have any questions? Just call the station at 719-539-1069 in the day. Do I have my guests here?
I'm certainly here, Melody. Thank
okay,
you for inviting me.
And Don.
I'm here too, yes.
Oh, great. Well, one of the things, I thought I had everything together, but I did walk off without my little bio cheat sheet to explain what my guests are all about. And so, William, I'm going to let you go ahead and start. Explain.
Well, I certainly will. Thank you very much, Melody, and thanks for inviting us with on KHAN. It's our pleasure to come in and share with your audience just a little bit about the Clean Water Restoration Act, Senate Bill 787. I'm certainly not the expert here. We have Don Parmeter with us from the American Property Coalition, and he'll be leading the charge for us this evening. Don, why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization and some of the work that you've been doing on this 787 bill?
Sure, and I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. We're based here. We organized 2 years ago to focus on this bill, and we also now have a coalition that works with the American Land Rights Alliance called the National Water and Conservation Alliance, and it's specifically designed to help kill this bill and put in some local and regional alternatives to achieving water quality objectives without giving more power to Washington.
Okay, and you know, William, you also have a radio program, several. One of them's on Oracle Broadcasting, and the other one is on Revolution Broadcasting. Is that what it's called now?
Yes, they keep changing the name on us, but it is now Revolution Broadcasting. I do a morning show on Oracle Broadcasting, oraclebroadcasting.com. I'm on from 9 to 11, Monday through Friday. And basically, we talk about a lot of issues, Agenda 21, philosophical radicalism, and all of that sort of stuff. And then on my revolutionbroadcasting.com broadcast from noon until 1, we focus mostly on the political issues and political parties and that sort of stuff, new issues, that kind of direction.
And I have a co-host tonight, Shannon Hemingway, and letting him get set up a little bit.
Good evening.
And so let's go ahead and just dig right into this Senate Bill 787, because this thing's starting to happen this week, and it might be quite significant for the public.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and start, Don?
And this bill actually is something that's been introduced in two previous sessions. Very controversial, and it was introduced on the Senate side by Senator Feingold this year, and last year by Congressman Jim Oberstar from Minnesota, who chairs the Transportation Committee, which has sole jurisdiction of this in the House. But the issue is really the Clean Water Restoration Act is extremely expansive. It expands federal power beyond anything we've ever seen, I think, in this country. In two ways. One, it changes the word navigable, which is now in the 1972 Clean Water Act, or the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, from navigable to waters of the United States, which includes everything, wetlands, sloughs, ponds, meadows, mud flats, sand flats, just about anything. And it adds new language activities affecting these waters. So it's not just an expansion of federal control over waters, but also land. So this is a huge issue. It's very controversial. Senator Barbara Boxer from California chairs the committee that has jurisdiction in the House. Because of large-scale grassroots opposition to this bill, over the last month, it's been held up in committee. And the committee is going to mark up a bill and try to pass it this Thursday. So we'll see what happens. There has not been a companion bill yet introduced in the House, but the House has received, Congressman Oberstar, the Transportation Committee chairman, has received a letter from the Obama administration signed by the Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Agriculture, Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Corps of Engineers, and the President's Council on Environmental Quality to basically expand the scope of the Clean Water Act. And so we expect the battle to go on, obviously in the Senate right now and then in the House later this summer.
I've also noticed on some of these bills that they like to introduce things at the same time or get people kind of split in a number of different directions, even though they may have reasons to be looking at a number of pieces of legislation at one point in time. And I noticed that the hate bill is up for being voted on, I believe, this week also. And so to tie that in with, there's just some really important constitutional issues and property rights issues that are right up and on the forefront right now.
Well, that's right. And radio is really the only media outside of the Internet, of course, the only medium picking up on the Clean Water Restoration Act and some of these property rights issues. The print media is, if they're covering it at all, they just kind of give lip service to it and endorse it. Yeah, we want clean water, but this bill isn't about clean water. It's about governance. It's whether you want more power in Washington or whether you want more power at home. It's really a top-down versus bottoms-up. And to me, you know, the general public is tired of Washington calling all the shots and expanding their power over people and people's lives. And I just think, we got to put a stop to this somehow.
Well, doesn't this also kind of harmonize with Agenda 21 and the UN's water desires to control all the waters of the world?
Well, that's right, and I think William probably wants to comment on that because he's studied the Agenda 21 and has made some linkage, a lot of the same language in that as exists in this bill, but you're absolutely right.
And what we're looking at there, folks, is the implementation of Chapter 18 of Agenda 21. And I know when I say that, a lot of people have no clue what we're talking about. But there was a forum, it's an Earth Summit Agenda 21, the United Nations Program of Action, which came from the Rio de Janeiro conference back in 1992. It was the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, the final text of agreements negotiated by governments at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, or UNCED, which was held June the 3rd to the 14th, so 1992. So we're looking at almost precisely the same time period, just a year removed, but this was down in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And Chapter 18 is titled Protection of the Quality and the Supply of Freshwater Resources, Application of Integrated Approaches to the Development, Management, and Use of Water Resources. And what Agenda 21 basically does is it transforms property ownership away from the people as owners into a collectivist mindset globally. So it really is a pernicious thing, but this bill just fits right into Chapter 18 like a glove.
Well, so I also would like to tie this in a little bit in with, we've got Nestle that is right at this point in time trying to get a permit on a 1041 approved with the county in this area. And normally, I would not necessarily think much about a any commercial entity wanting to have an opportunity to purchase rights that they feel that they should be entitled to. But there's a lot more hidden under this, and the timing with them applying for this permit can be interesting, to say the least. Don?
I'm sorry. I was going to say, a lot of these cases and this legislation is being driven by two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, one in 2001, the Swank decision in Northern Cook County, Illinois, and in 2006, the Rapanos decision in Michigan, which basically said that the Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection are already exceeding their authority under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. This bill would go way beyond restoring. Basically, it was the camel under the nose, under the tent. Camel's nose under the tent. Let's just keep taking and taking and taking until somebody stops us. Well, the Supreme Court stopped them twice, and so now they are taking the opportunity. Well, let's not just seize federal control of all waters. Let's have a national water land use control bill as well. So, I mean, this is the biggest federal power grab in the nation's history. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think it's patently unconstitutional. A number of constitutional attorneys have said that. Meanwhile, people are, getting killed by these agencies who just keep grabbing and reaching and overreaching and making people's lives miserable. Some of these court cases go on for 10, 15 years. A landowner in Minnesota, for one example, fighting seven different federal and state agencies, and has spent $500,000 on attorney's fees, accumulated over 500,000 pages of documentation, and there's no end in sight. It's been doing this for a dozen years. I mean, it's crazy. And there are criminal penalties, too, for people that violate these this act. So, and people have actually served jail time, hard jail time, in maximum security prisons for wetlands violations.
And essentially what this is saying then, that everybody's in a watershed.
That's right.
Area. So
everybody's vulnerable under this act, mm-hmm. because it really is about control of watersheds, and everything's in a watershed. Everything. All land, maybe, all people, all water, all things.
Maybe we need to back up a little bit, Don, and let's talk about the difference between navigable and non-navigable or non-navigable waters, so that people get an understanding. What is the current understanding? What is the definition, if you would, of navigable waters according to the federal government?
Well, that's interesting, because that's a point of contention now, because obviously navigation is something that can apply to commerce. And if you look at who has jurisdiction over this issue, i.e. the Transportation Committee, it's really basically telling you it's a transportation issue. And it's not meant to expand into wetlands and isolated wetlands and ponds and intermittent streams. Those are not navigable waters. But then they add, goes way beyond navigability to activities affecting these waters, most of which are not navigable. And it's really hard to imagine any significant human activity that doesn't affect waters.
William, do you have the wording there that gets into a little bit of what he's talking about on the different types of water?
Well, when we look at navigable water, traditionally we're talking about water that could actually be used in commerce and something that would float your boat, I guess would be one way you could say it. This bill attempts to change the definition of navigable water, which would perhaps be something you'd think of, Mark Twain going down the Mississippi with his paddle wheel boat, or you might think of hauling barges along and things like that, carrying cargo, or perhaps you could think of a motor boat or something. But a navigable water goes all the way down to a canoe and whatnot, but a kayak, can go across, if you're careful, even a wet lawn. But what we're talking about here is a transformation, a considerable change in the idea of what is navigable water, when we start to introduce things like any area that could be inundated at any one time of the year, we go back and understand the FEMA's hazard mitigation programming, anything that could be inundated with water. Let's say that you've got a low spot in your yard or perhaps a low spot in your pasture that when you get a heavy rain or the snow melt and water accumulates or ponds there, that can be one of these intermittent ponds, and it would come under federal jurisdiction. If you were to have something like a these little playa lakes that they call them, you go out into the or a farm pond. There's more and more interest in farm ponds today, and this could also come under this category. If you're a developer and you're trying to develop land, and you're it's discovered through an ecologist working on the land, a biologist, that you have a piece of ground that could be considered a wetland. This could come under this particular legislation and be defined as navigable water. So by redefining this term in commerce, in taking it away from its traditional understanding, it basically opens up to federal supervision all of the waters of in the continental United States and all of the aquifers and all of the watersheds. And so it becomes an enormous beast that the average person is completely oblivious to.
Well, wouldn't the... Is this saying that the federal legislation then would supersede the state?
Yes. Yes. Basically, this takes away land use authority away from local government, transfers to the federal government. Some of the legislators here have said, does that mean we can do away with our DNR and our Pollution Control Agency? You know, it's half joking, but basically, yes, the federal authority would trump all other state authority and local authority.
Let me just give this to you right out of the act, folks. This is the, and you can get this on the internet. You can go up and type in 111th Congress, First Session, Senate Bill S-787. This is to amend the Federal Water Pollution Control Act to clarify the jurisdiction of the United States over waters of the United States. And here is how they define it here, Section 8. This act will treat as waters of the United States those features that were treated as such pursuant to the regulations of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Corps of Engineers in existence before the dates of the decisions referred to in paragraph 10, including, now listen to what it includes, and see if you don't agree with me that it includes all water, but it says section 10, or section 8A, all waters which are subject to the ebb and flow of the tide. And so by that we can understand all of the waters, the boundary waters, anything that is parts of the ocean, any of your inland sounds and things. B, all interstate waters, including interstate wetlands. And so now we've included the Mississippi River, the Arkansas, and all the rest of the rivers, interstate waters. Any big lakes like Table Rock Lake or any of the big lakes in your area, Melody. Any lakes that are standing behind a dam, for instance. All waters, this is C, all waters, all other waters, such as intrastate lakes, rivers, streams, including intermittent streams, mud flats, sand flats, wetlands, sloughs, prairie potholes, wet meadows, playa lakes, or natural ponds. D, all impoundments of waters of the United States. E, tributaries of the aforementioned waters. F, the territorial seas. And G, wetlands adjacent to the aforementioned waters. So it fairly well sums it up. But in addition to that, Section 9 then goes on to include groundwaters treated separately from the waters of the United States for purposes of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act and are not considered waters of the United States under this act. So it disclaims the one but retains the other. So as you can see, it's rather broad in scope.
Can you explain what impoundments of waters of the United States means?
An impoundment of water would be a farm pond. It would also be any thing that is behind a dam. Whether that be an earth dam or a concrete dam, whatever, any of the water that you could even consider actually sewage treatment plants and the clarifying ponds, these are all impoundments.
Are aquifers impoundments?
No, an aquifer is a natural basin subterranean, so that wouldn't be necessarily included in this. But groundwaters are treated separately from the waters of the United States, according to Section 9. And then there are additional things. I'm just reading two sections out of the bill.
Okay, then who might those aquifers or groundwaters come under the jurisdiction of?
Well, that would be something maybe Don could address. I don't know. Do you have that on your mind, Don?
I'm not really sure. I'd have to research that. Obviously, there's a connection there in some cases, but I'm not really sure.
I'm getting a bit of feedback between my connection and Don's. Are you hearing Don clearly, Melody?
Yeah. Okay, I don't, and I'll tell you the truth, I'm not quite sure what I need to do to adjust it either. Is that helping at all? Is it?
Well, we'll have to hear Don. Don?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you okay.
Okay.
I just wanted to add, because I think we need to understand where this thing is going, where all this is going, and there is a 60-page background report that was done by the Oberstar staff on this bill. And it says about two dozen times in the report that the unfinished agenda of the Clean Water Act is control of non-point source water pollution. That is key. Now, some people, you know, they think, well, what's non-point source water pollution? It's everything that doesn't come out of a pipe. That's the simple definition. It includes agriculture. It includes forestry. It includes mining. It includes home building, any kind of property improvement, any disturbance of soil. Mowing your lawn is a non-point source. Okay, washing your car in your driveway, putting a dock in, building, maintaining a recreational trail, using a recreational trail. All of these things are non-point sources of pollution that the environmental community and certain members of Congress want to expand it to that extent so they can essentially control all land and all water in the United States. It's that dramatic and that radical.
If that is a harmonizing legislation with the UN's Agenda 21, are you familiar with how other countries have been dealing with this kind of restriction?
I'm not that familiar with what other countries are doing. I can't imagine other countries would have legislation that's this extreme. I think this is the most extreme. In fact, the attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, who was the lead attorney on the Supreme Court case, the Rapanos decision, said this bill pushes the limits of federal power to an extreme not matched by any other law, probably in the history of the country. Maybe there's some countries that have this kind of thing, but my goodness, in this country of freedom, I can't imagine having that kind of a federal control over our lives. And let me add this too, you know, because some people, this is being opposed broadly by all segments of society outside of the environmental community for the most part. But there are local and regional and state alternatives to these. Better, faster, cheaper. This bill is not about clean water. It's a power grab. And it's control of non-point source pollution. And some people say, well, yeah, the federal government should control that. Well, let's understand what that means. That means essentially they control every acre of land and water is up for grabs as to what kind of human activity can be allowed. And I don't know that we want federal bureaucrats based in Washington making the call on that.
Well, one of the concerns that I foresee taking place with this and it would be the fact that the financial condition that this country is in and already seeing that our infrastructure and resources could possibly be up for grabs, and that you know that water would be like number one on their list.
Mm-hmm. Well, this will certainly exacerbate the economic situation. The only people that would benefit would be environmental activists and attorneys. You know, because there would be endless litigation under something like that to determine what activity should be allowed. And I can't even imagine the size of the bureaucracy that would be needed to implement something like this. It's staggering.
Yeah, I'm wondering just in our own country, I think I was off for a second, you know, leaving other countries aside, your projection for the worst case application of this law, I'm wondering about. And maybe we need to clarify. I mean, we went through the Section 8 there and all of it was included. If you look at the section right after that, in section 10, they talk about how, you know, the ability to achieve the national objective of, you know, keeping the water clean, basically, what do they say, in order to meet the national objective of restoring and maintaining the chemical, physical, and biological integrity. That's the original point of the Clean Water Act, right? So then they go on to say that there was actually some court cases where, you know, there was confusion caused, delays, increased costs, litigation, as you're saying. So some of that has already occurred. But if you look at some of the cases that they discuss, they talk U.S. versus Riverside Bayview Homes, where the Supreme Court has already held that the jurisdictions over wetlands adjacent is, you know, evidenced in the intent to regulate at least some of the waters that would not be deemed navigable. So there's been a slippery slope a little bit on this already.
Sure, absolutely.
And then they go on actually to say that there's a Cook County case. I don't know if that was the one. There's another
one. That's the Swank 2001 case.
Huh? Right. This is Chicago, and then apparently there's another one, Detroit Timber and Lumber. But they're all saying that, you know, everybody can see that navigable waters, you know, wouldn't mean much if you're allowed to pollute waters. In this one, Army Corps versus a solid waste consortium from suburban Chicago. I mean, the logic of it all, from a common sense point of view, yeah, you certainly wouldn't want the technical, you know, control to end if the control is just to keep the water clean and you could actually pollute the adjacent wetland, and then, you know, that kind of defeats the purpose of it in the first place. But having established those ideas, say I'm naive enough to think that Agenda 21 is what it says it is, and that the government's doing its best job to actually just continue to protect the integrity of the water. What am I missing, or how naive could a person be, and what are they missing if they don't see this massive power grab? And what do you think is the, like I say, worst case scenario of it?
What, you want me to start on that? I think the worst case scenario, which honestly, I think there's too much opposition to this bill. I don't think the worst case scenario will prevail this year. That's my personal opinion. I may be wrong, but there have been many members, including Congressman Salazar from Colorado, who have taken a very strong opposing view of the bill as it is and helped block it last year in Oberstar's committee. So this isn't a partisan thing. The worst case scenario would be that the federal government controls all watersheds in the United States. You know, I think that would be unconstitutional. And I'm not a constitutional attorney. I'm not an attorney at all. But I've heard constitutional attorneys make the case that that would really violate, you know, the Constitution in terms of limited federal powers. In fact, Jim Burling, one of the senior property rights attorneys, one of the best in the country, said, you know, if our constitutional system of limited powers, limited federal powers means anything, we have to win on this issue, on this Clean Water Act issue. Worst case scenario, federal government controls all land and all water.
And how does that play out badly?
All concentration of federal powers in Washington, and almost none at the local and state level in terms of resources, natural resources.
So we could assume.
I mean, there are people that think that's great, you know. Let's have centralized power in Washington. I think most people don't want that. In Minnesota, we had a federal Wild and Scenic Rivers bill, an omnibus bill, back in, oh gosh, the late 80s. And we collectively as a state and local units of government killed it and replaced it with a joint powers board of local elected officials who actually are on the ground and come up with solutions that will both meet environmental quality objectives without destroying the economy and the culture of the region. That's the alternative. That's kind of the flip side of centralized power, which is to decentralize it. And there's no reason, you know, it can be done faster, better, and cheaper. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think this is really a fundamental basis and a fundamental difference in philosophy of government. Whether we want to expand power in Washington or whether we want to give more power back to the people.
I think you make that case well. I'm wondering if there's a listener right now who's thinking, hey, you know, when people want to pollute, sometimes they can pay off their local people. Maybe we need it to be centralized, like you're saying.
You know,
but what is, you know, what happens when there's a federal control over any issue, water or otherwise, and the local people don't really get, like you say, a shared power council on it?
Well, they don't get a voice on that, essentially. But I mean, if you take anything that's taking place right now, it is pretty clear that it's like if the people win, the legislation keeps coming back and coming back and coming back until the people have either lost the issue or it has been diluted so bad that what they were protesting is already in place.
Well, one thing, if I could jump in here, one thing that I see and what I'm hearing here is that we're not taking into consideration private property rights, the rights of a person to determine what the highest and best use of their land might be, whether you're ranching, whether you're farming, whether you just have retired and live someplace in the country. You are the ostensible owner of that property, and it should be left up to you as to how you utilize your property. Now, going all the way back to William Blackstone's The Commentaries on the Laws of England, it's been a very well-established common law principle that whatever I do on my property, I'm welcome to do, provided that I don't interfere with my neighbor's use. And if I have a creek or a stream or a pond or lake, anything that I do that disturbs their use, that's an affront to their property rights. So if we can come to an understanding that my rights end where the rights of another begin, then we have to be able to look at our local area, our counties, and then at our states or our regions, and then our states, and then at the federal government, and apply the same yardstick there equally. But beyond that, this is actually the implementation of a global strategy. This is the implementation of Agenda 21. Just to give you an idea of the harmonization between this international agreement and this particular bill, this bill in Section 3.1 says that, says that water is transported through interconnected hydrological cycles and the pollution, impairment, or the destruction of any part of an aquatic system and blah, blah, blah. Listen to the way that it starts out in Agenda 21. Freshwater resources are an essential component of the Earth's hydrosphere and an indispensable part of all terrestrial ecosystems. The freshwater environment is characterized by the hydrological cycle, including floods and droughts, which in some regions have become more extreme and dramatic and blah, blah, blah. You drop down and it says, the widespread scarcity, gradual destruction, and aggravated pollution of freshwater resources, blah, blah, blah. Go all the way down. Water supply and sanitation, agriculture, industry, urban development, hydropower generation, inland fisheries, transportation, recreation, and so on and so forth. And these words are just basically lifted out of the Agenda 21 and transported into this federal initiative. So what we're doing basically is we're implementing this global agenda on a nationwide or a nation-state basis, but which will eventually be a global initiative. It's just like today where we hear about the cap and trade or the carbon tax or carbon credits and all of that. These all come from the same sources. So we have to ask ourselves, are we involved in social equity here? Is this social justice? What brand of law is this? Are we following the diktat of the United Nations, or are we truly a sovereign people, and are we free on our own land, or are we just serfs on a global plantation? So there's so much to discuss in all of this, but I think it's easy to say that far better a solution here would be the local solution, where your county or your city or your town or your state could make these decisions based upon local conditions and not come under the blanket umbrella of the United Nations diktat globally.
Well, and if I could add to, this idea that, well, you know, people get bought off at the local level and polluters get away. They don't anymore. You know, when we surveyed people, when we did the local rivers initiative as a substitute to the Federal Wild and Scenic Rivers, you know, people surveyed along the river, landowners, fishermen, people that use the river. Number one concern about the rivers and the lakes, rivers in this case, water quality. You know, nobody wants water quality more than people that live next to a river use it. the difference is you got people on the ground, and there was a lot of screaming. The Forest Service at the higher levels really were bothered, and they considered these rivers their rivers because they were in the boundary of a national forest. Forest Service people that had to live in the community said, thank you for giving us an opportunity at the local level to fix this problem. It can be done faster, cheaper, and better. The problem is it takes power away from these big special interest groups, whatever their philosophy in Washington. They don't like it. The attorneys don't like it because it takes it out of the courts. They love to sue. And there hasn't been hardly any screaming over this local solution for river quality and river management. No reason why that can't happen on a larger scale. And that's really what's at stake here, in my opinion, is a philosophy of government.
And one thing more that I could add to that, Don, if I could jump in again, is simply this. So often what we're asked to do is to give up so much for these very specious arguments. Well, what if, you know, it's like the little boy holding the balloons, what if, you know, and they let go of the balloons. The idea of what if some small manufacturer, a small business in some town is dumping chemicals in the local storm sewer. What if? Should all of the people in the United States of America, all of the landowners, all of the millions and millions of square miles come under this new federal jurisdiction based on a potential what if? Should everyone in the United States of America be asked to give up their guns because somebody shoots somebody they oughtn't? These are the kind of arguments that I like to bring up here. As being both arbitrary and capricious when we think about the wide, broad, sweeping, you know, the big brush of the United Nations coming in and going around the world. But certainly the implementation, getting the public buy-in at the local level, you can always, you know, wring your handkerchiefs over this specific incident, and government loves that. But really, are we willing to sacrifice all of our freedom for the what if? Why don't we just get our legal system in order and go after those what-ifs one at a time? You know, we had the Superfund cleanup where we were asked to pay and pay and pay and pay, loaning money into existence, creating debt to clean up the waste of World Wars I and World Wars II, all the way back really to the founding of this country in the Eastern Seaboard and at various other places in the coastal areas and such. We were asked to pay all of that, and we did that. We went through that Superfund cleanup program. But again, is that fair? If we have corporations that have run amok, let's put the onus on the corporation to clean up their own mess. You know, they've soiled the nest for everyone else. Now it's time for them to clean it up. So instead of just allowing people to walk away with the profits and leave the mess behind, we need a personal accountability and responsibility on the local level, and we don't need this kind of a federal intrusion in all of our lives just to justify these one point here and one point there type of hot spots, in my opinion.
One of the things that I find kind of perplexing is that we're dealing with corporations that they are pretty much amoral, and yet they ride the fence and want to be treated as if they have human rights. And yet when it comes to this sort of pollution thing, we've got a place down south of here that one gold mining corporation came in and just thoroughly polluted the river and up and left. And this river is not usable at this point.
That's interesting. And it's interesting, too, that the environmental movement, which I was part of back in the 70s, but I kind of bailed out. I'm a recovering environmentalist now because I found out what their agenda was, and it wasn't about environmental quality. But it started out really as a grassroots movement, a legitimate, needed grassroots movement. It is now funded to the tune of between $4 and $5 billion a year by corporate foundations. Figure that one out.
Help us figure it out. Go further with that.
Will you go further with that a little bit?
I'm sorry.
Will you go further with that? Since you were inside,
what I'm saying is the environmental movement has become an industry in itself, a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah, when I worked for them, I was sad to see.
And most of their funds come from, all you have to do is Google the Environmental Grantmakers Association, started 20 years ago by a handful of corporate founders. foundations. It's now up to, I think, 400 or 500. And you can find that on the Internet. It doesn't give the amounts, but there are some researchers that have totally amounts. But it will give you the names of all the hundreds of corporate foundations that are giving and who it's going to. And there are hundreds and hundreds. In Minnesota alone, we have 80 environmental organizations. One of those, which does nothing but sue pretty much, has 20 staff people. I mean, there are millions of dollars flowing in. And on the economic front, I just want to say this, because we did some math on this. The part of the Clean Water Act, which is about a 250-page document, by the way, it's very extensive, is what's known as TMDL, Total Maximum Daily Load, which essentially tells you, or is supposed to tell you, what a body of water can absorb without degradation of water quality. And the Environmental Protection Agency some years ago estimated that to do a study of a body of water costs about $1 million. Well, in Minnesota, there are about 50,000 bodies of water, rivers and lakes. If you multiply 50,000 by a million, you get $50 billion just to do the studies. That doesn't give you a drop of clean water. Where is that money going to come from? My gosh, it's just a bottomless pit. And, you know, elected officials don't want to talk about that, the fact, but I cannot imagine the cost of implementing something like this. It's just staggering.
And I think
the money, this is a money issue. This is a issue about money. And, you know, environmental organizations don't just have office space in Washington. They own buildings, for Pete's sake. You know, and it's and there's really no other side. It's kind of like, well, we have to save the planet, and so therefore, you got all these politicians jumping on board to have clean energy, clean water, clean. It's very politically appealing, but what we're losing in the process is our freedom in our intended system of governance, in my opinion.
One of the researcher that I respect quite a bit had brought up the fact that back in the Bush administration that they had gutted a lot of the environmental protections on the waters, and so she was, you know, leaning towards this, the wording of this Clean Water Act, which kind of struck me. I didn't expect that, and because at the same time, in some of the other research that she was showing us in graphs, say on weather control and things of this sort, or geoengineering, I think is what they kind of call it, and it has to do with often the last people to hear about what's going on in these programs are the people. And when they're doing any kind of studies or implementation of experimental avenues, we don't hear about it until way after the fact.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think if we work towards more locally driven solutions, then more people can be not only involved in government, but in solving some of these problems, and it's there's accountability at the local level. And this can be done either through formal or informal joint powers arrangements among local elected officials. You know, something that has some basis in some ecological basement, like a watershed. But, you know, the agencies are just coming in and running roughshod over people. Laws are passed. People don't get excited. We had, you know, here in Minnesota, we had a state wetlands conservation act that was passed in 1991. Hardly anybody blinked at it until it was implemented in 93. Then there was a revolution. I mean, people were mad. I mean, it was really scary for a while. And that's what we're afraid of is going to happen with this bill. It gets passed, and people say, yeah, we want clean water. Yeah, go to it, Congress. Well, and then it starts being implemented, and my goodness, it's too late then. It's almost too late, because it's really hard. And I don't believe any environmental laws have been gutted. You know, some of these things have, you know, are subject to different interpretations, and the courts are all over the place on some of these property rights issues. But for the most part, since these environmental laws, including and especially the Clean Water Act in 1972, were passed, we've made enormous progress in cleaning up our nation's waters. But it takes time, and it costs billions of dollars. And so I think a law like this will set us back, both economically and environmentally. and it further disenfranchises people from their government.
Well,
yeah, let's look at enforcement just for a minute, Don and Melody and Sean. Let's think about this from the standpoint that there are 3,066 counties all across America. And if in each of these 3,066 counties of America, we were to set up a new office, a new agency, and establish a new federal branch, similar in maybe in respect to your county extension agency or one of your soil and water conservation districts, which we already have, by the way, if we were going to go ahead and do that, then we'd at least have to have 3,066 new employees. Of course, you know, government thrives on the mantra that they're overworked, understaffed, and underpaid. And so in government, you have to move up, move out, or die. And so you want to work towards inefficiency always. You need to exhaust your budgets every single year or you don't get funded the next. And so this can just then mushroom into this colossus, which would certainly fulfill the president's goal to have massive 500,000 plus new hirers, new hirees, if you will, all of that. We have this enormous new government system being set up. But take it again to the next level and understand that corporations, you brought it up, Melody, and it is very timely, corporations are behind all of this. Of course, your county is a corporation, just as all of these various and sundry environmental organizations are corporations. But all of the various corporations, like the gold mining corporation that was down working in the river that they polluted, one could ask, why wasn't that corporation censored for polluting that? Why was no one in your county paying attention and watching that? But what we have here basically is a kind of a collusion between businesses. We get so locked into this idea of a economic development that your county will look one way while a local corporation is working, providing employment and all of that. You know, this is part of the argument that Nestle is advancing, that they'll have all of this new labor, new revenues coming in, so the county would just kind of turn its back on perhaps what Nestle may be doing in the local aquifer. But we've got good companies or corporations all across America who have been the demons of the pollution system that no one wants to talk about. We don't want to talk about Boeing. We don't want to talk about Hewlett-Packard. We don't want to talk about General Electric or DuPont or any of the other corporations. We don't want to talk about Walmart. We don't want to talk about the runoff from their huge parking lots and so on and so forth. So it really comes down, I believe, that just as we said previously, this is a local issue. And it can be best addressed locally by the very people that are already holding positions of power. But we're going to have to get out of this idea of turning our backs and allowing graft and corruption and pollution and all these other things to go on in the name of environmental and developmental concerns throughout America and around the world. So we're implementing a national or a global initiative on a national level, impacting the local level. There's nothing in this bill to finance this. There's nothing in this bill to actually implement it. Lots of nice words, but how does this ever come into existence? So it's another one of these very poorly thought through, poorly planned pieces of legislation that will be handed over to an agency. Now, once it's handed over to the agency, it's just like the Internal Revenue Service or any of the other agencies out there. Who's going to oversight them? And how are we going to have redress of grievance with them? So I just see so many red flags on this particular piece of legislation that I could reject it out of hand. Back to you, Melody.
Well, and as far as those that are growing food or ranching and things of that sort, I could see that that would be highly impact their operations, because there is hardly anything that they do that wouldn't or couldn't have some effect that would maybe be a violation on these terms.
Well, how would one go about putting in 1,000 acres of soybeans, or how would one go about putting in 1,000 acres or more of corn, whether you're using it for biofuel or whether you're using it to feed the people? How could you do any of that without having non-point groundwater pollution being generated, just simply because every time it rains, that water is going to run to the low spot, and then it's going to need to, you know, be dealt with at that point? And typically and traditionally, that water will just soak into the ground and you'll have a wet spot in your pasture. You know you're not going to be able to get much crop out of that, but you've graded your land that way and you understand it. Certainly around here, there's lots of, I'm down in southwest Missouri. We have a lot of soybean growers down here. We've got a lot of corn being grown down here. And I just can't wrap my mind around having this level of federal administration on the backs of our farmers.
Well, if I was a corporation, one of the things that I would be pushing for would be centralization. That means you only have one entity that you have to deal with and lobby for.
Absolutely.
And I've run into this in the insurance industry where, you would hear them put out the word here and there about how they, you know, didn't want to deal with 50 states and this sort. And it had some viability in their argument. But what I'm really seeing that's taking place is it just made it too easy for one to have no scrutiny over these companies on the national level. And I think that's kind of what happened with AIG. So I could see it easily happening in the water industry. I mean, there's so much more money that would be involved in that.
Well, yeah, you know, I agree with that. And secondly, you know, I mean, I think we need to work towards more decentralization of government. But there's an ecological basis for doing it locally, too, and that is landscapes are different all over the country. So a one-size-fits-all doesn't work. I mean, the way you manage, there's a county commissioner in Idaho that we work with, and the National Association of Counties is very opposed to this. And he came to Minnesota, and he said, you know, the first observation is, well, you don't manage high desert country in Idaho from a water standpoint like you manage the Red River Valley or the Granite Rock of northeast Minnesota. You know, it's got to be tailored to the needs and what makes sense on the ground. And the only people that can really determine that are the people that live there and use the area and understand it. That's where the solution to these problems are going to come, knowing that, you know, anything we do, you know, as humans, any kind of human activity is going to have a little impact on the environment. And one thing in the pollution control business that's basically understood from the get-go, and that is, you know, trying to clean up the remaining 1% or 2% of water pollution or air pollution is going to cost a lot more than cleaning up the first 98%. So you've got to put economics into this thing, too. What's it going to cost? What is the most cost-effective way of achieving water quality objectives? And secondly, we've got to prioritize. Clean up the navigable waters, number one priority. That's what the Clean Water Act says. And yes, there is an impact with streams that flow into that. But that, turning that over to the federal bureaucracy is not going to solve the problem. I think it's going to make it worse and it's going to cost more. It gets back to the philosophy of government, I think. And obviously there are the Mississippi River that traverses many states. You know, that's a special exception. No question that that's something that needs to be addressed under the Clean Water Act.
I think you both have, you know, these excellent points. And I guess I'd feel more comfortable turning over, not trying to look higher. I mean, I do not want to look to a daddy government, even in the state. But when you look at what people really do, I'm from Michigan, and you know, along the Tittabawassee River, downstream from the Dow plant in Midland, this is Dow Chemical Corporation, the Bhopal people and all that, there's a huge amount of hexachlorobenzene and a huge amount of dioxin. The people in that area have been surveyed. 65% of the fishermen there still eat what they catch in the Tittabawassee River. That's just those surveyed. You know that number's going to be higher. And, you know, what we're really dealing with is to clean up the waters. We don't want them to be on fire anymore like they were over
there.
That's right. But, you know, what we're really dealing with is, you know, the cleanliness of the water for what? Just for the, you know, it's just like we want our rights or sovereignty just to have it? No, we want them to use. And if more people were like you two, and we're, you know, uppity in the fact that they would do something with their sovereignty and push even harder once they defeat this bill, and instead of just saying, okay, now we fixed things because everything was great already. It's not.
But, that's right.
You know,
you're right.
It's cancer.
You've got to have an alternative.
Right?
Without an alternative to this bill, you know, it's untenable the way it is.
Okay, so you're...
And so I think this is a positive thing that this thing is coming to a light. I think it's a positive thing that the Supreme Court in two instances said, wait a minute here. You know, what is the federal jurisdiction? What is the constitutionality of this? And so it's forced really a debate about this and about environmental quality in general and about the Constitution, about what kind of government we want. And hopefully it'll, I'm an eternal optimist here. But without an alternative or alternatives, we're dead.
Well, let's go.
There are plenty of examples across the country of local alternatives that work, and environmental groups, other than complaining about they lost power or they lost their ability to sue somebody and go to court and create a full employment act for an environmental attorney, they have no complaints or little complaints.
Well, let's go to the Dow Chemical Company. All right, so we've got a river. We have a river that's been polluted by chemicals. It's traceable. It's detectable. We can locate the source of the pollution. It's probably been known since the plant was built, by the way. The engineering would show that. But anyway, so we've got a polluter, we have a source, and we have trouble. And now, what are we going to do with Dow Chemical? Well, Dow has an incredible lobby. They're one of those companies that's just too big to fail. So what are we going to do? Well, what happens, and traditionally, even back prior to the Superfund cleanup, this is not the first time this sort of stuff has come down the pike, but that was back in the 70s. So a lot of people have forgotten about that or moved up, moved out, or died. But so what are you going to do about Dow Chemical? Now we're dealing with one specific problem. And now, how are we going to go about cleaning it up? And who is going to pay for that? Well, certainly, the pocket that took the profit is the one that should be doing the cleanup, not the rancher out in Nebraska. Are you with me, Sean?
Yeah. Okay. And they control a lot of that. They control what's going to be measured, how the tests are going to go to see whether or not. You know what they've done recently is exceeded the local, I don't know what the watershed group is, but and the National Resource Defense Council is who it was. And they say, we set this what we thought was a very high goal of a 38% reduction, and Dow has exceeded our expectations by reducing that particular contaminant by 43%.
But is that enough?
Who controlled what they were testing? And if you look at Philadelphia Inquirer, May 5th, 1983, a high death rate from a rare cancer in Midland County cannot be linked to dioxin produced by Dow Chemical Company, the State Department of Public Health reported yesterday.
And isn't it nice that the State Department of Public Health is also a corporation? They receive funding, they receive grants and aid. All of the people that work for them went through the public and the land grant colleges and universities. So when we set something up like minimum standards, minimum codes, what we're basically saying is anything over this is too much, but anything under this is okay. But it's still pollution. It's still wrong. And it's still the cost. It should still be the burden of the polluter. I mean, there's just, in my mind, I had a property up in New York, and it was right outside of Niagara Falls in the Love Canal area, and it was so caustic that when I got done doing my research on it, I wanted nothing to do with it, and I put it up for sale immediately without ever having seen it. But, that's the problem that we have. We have people that have made a fortune, plundering, pillaging, robbing, raping, burning, and stealing. They take the walk, the people get the time. And I think this has to stop. This bill would basically transfer that guilt and that cost to all of the people in the United States of America just the same way as we're taking the costs of the derivatives bubble and transferring that off to the children of this generation, the next generation, and the next.
Well, and if I could add to that, too, and talk a little bit about the politics of the bill. Because, I mean, this thing is really getting political. And,
let's do that. But can you hold that thought for a second? Let's let Melody go
sure.
For the top of the hour.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody. And this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my co-host this evening is Shannon Hemingway, and I also, and my guests tonight are William Roberts and Don Parmenter, and we're talking about Senate Bill 787. So go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the politics and a bill like this has a lot of politics. But Senator Baucus, who is the leading opponent on the Democratic side on this, and they're working towards finding some compromise or a bill that can get passed through committee so it can move forward. But what they're doing is basically finding out who's complaining the loudest and then trying to appease that group. In the case of certain farm interests, and now the NRA. So Senator Baucus is trying to appease the NRA, and so the NRA says, well, we're happy. Well, what about everybody else? You know, the fact is most landowners and most public land users are not farmers. And so when we start amending and creating exemptions for all these special interest groups, who gets left out in the dark? The regular public. You know, if somebody told me, said, I bet there isn't going to be an exemption for John Q. Public. No, because they don't have a lobby in Washington. They don't have a building. They don't have office space. And so, again, I think most people are going to get disenfranchised by something like this.
Most people disenfranchise themselves, it seems.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a this
that's
is
true, too. You're
politically
right.
Incorrect
a lot of apathy and,
show like this
and,
to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I don't disagree with that at all.
I mean, but maybe what you're advocating for is the rights of the 5% of the people who actually still, you know, give a hoot and would go to court.
What we found is if you, and I bring this up too, that exists in other countries, if you find a local alternative to a federal program that people are nervous about or oppose outwardly, and you give them an opportunity, and if they think they are going to make a difference, you know, and can affect change in a meaningful way, they will show up, you know. And I guarantee they'll show up if a bill like this passes and it starts to get implemented, you know. I mean, there was a full-scale revolt over the Wetlands Conservation Act here in Minnesota, so people do care.
Melody.
But I think one of the problems is they've become so cynical and so apathetic, they just don't think they can make a difference.
And, you know, to sort of hedge on what I've said, I mean, how many hundreds of people have we seen here showing up at the Nestle meetings?
And one of the things that you just brought up and what you were talking about on this legislation, even among the Congress, it sounds like they're doing playing some of the same social games.
Problem, reaction, solution,
and they're also using kind of like the Delphi technique on their own Congress.
Sure. And I have to say, and I was in Congressman Oberstar's district, lived in his district for 30 years. He's using the bully pulpit, the chairman of the Transportation Committee, to get his way. This is his number one priority. This is a legacy for him. And so, and every Congress, every congressional district needs Congressman Oberstar's support for road money, for infrastructure money. And so, in my opinion, that's an abuse of power, you know, but he's using it. And that's got to stop. I think ultimately that's got to stop. People do not like that.
They don't like it, but it seems to be the way of doing business in Congress from what my take on it.
Well, yeah. And I've heard people say, you know, well, it seems like members of Congress have just kind of, they quit representing their constituents and they're representing somebody else. My comeback to that is that's because the people that elected them are letting them get away with that. And I understand the power of incumbency and so forth, but I think people are going to have to demand something better, representative government.
Well, and, you know, we sometimes condemn the system, but we fail to recognize the core or the problem in that. And ever since the 1700s, the idea of representative government has been out the window. It's easy to say it, but it's impossible to do. There was never an intention that any of the so-called elected representatives ever represent we the people. It's always their constituency, but the constituency in this country is locked up between the established two-party political system and all of the various lobbyists that keep that system going. So the real constituents here are the deep pockets that contribute, whether they're contributing to Rick Perry, Texas Governor Rick Perry's campaign contributions box so that he can come back. And as he does, he brings forward this Trans-Texas Corridor and the involvement with the Sintra Company. But on a global scale, I think that if Melody and Shannon and Don, if we think about the implementation of Agenda 21 and truly take the time to understand what I'm talking about when I say that, then we can start to get a better understanding of what all of this is all about. Because if we forget the plan or the program or the agenda, then these various other things come along look like symptoms. But here, pursuant, this is Section 1815 again. This is out of the protection of water quality, fresh water supplies, etc. The chapter, right out of Agenda 21, the book, Section 1815. Pursuant to the recognition of water as a social and economic good, the various available options for charging water users, including domestic, urban, industrial, and agricultural water user groups, have to be further evaluated and field tested. Further development is required for economic instruments that take into account opportunity costs and environmental externalities. Field studies on the willingness to pay should be conducted in rural and urban situations, and so on. What we're talking about is we're turning water into a commodity, much like oil, and we're going to be charged for every drop that we use, whether we use it in an urban, whether we use it in an industrial, whether we use it in a rural, as a farming situation, no matter how we use it. When we turn on the tap, we're to be charged. And so these kind of initiatives coming on us and at us globally, both in the southern and the northern hemispheres, both in the developed and the developing countries, it's all about one thing. It's about the control of water. And water is a social and economic good. And so our whole relationship with planet Earth is being altered through the implementation of Agenda 21 as it seeks to tax us for every blade of grass, every grain of sand, all of our inputs, all of our outputs. And basically, if there are useless eaters anywhere on the planet, they are considered to be expendable. And there are plans from these very same authors for the elimination of the bulk of humanity. So these are some of the things that we want to be very aware of and understand that this is not a program of action that we want to participate in. And anything and everything that we can do to block it locally is to our own best interest.
Well, one of the things that you just brought up is that, you know, it seems like we're usually just putting out fires. And one of the things that we are not doing as a public and aren't even really trained to do, but I've watched this done on corporations time and time again, is they project. They project into the future. They project years into the future. And where is this going? Well, I was watching the Davos meetings. Is that Davos, Switzerland? One of the things that kept coming up and coming up and coming up was about water shortages. I found that quite interesting because it was though they were trying to mentally prepare us for something that they had coming down the road, whether we really had water shortage or not. Some places do, but other places don't.
Well, if you know, there's a movie called The Corporation, and it's great for all kinds of legal background, but in there they interview... Oh, I wish I knew the guy's name, but he states quite unequivocally, everything needs to be owned. The efficient use of all resources will not happen until it's owned by a particular person. And person is the word they get into in the corporation because of the way the corporations have used personhood so much. But I'd also like you to comment. Here's a little blurb from The Economist where they say that, you know, treating water as a right makes the scarcity even worse because everybody wants it and holds on to it longer. And that because the efficient water use would be encouraged by charging for it, but attempts to do so have mostly proved politically impossible, they state that a more practicable alternative is a system of tradable water usage rights. The article is basically about China. What is your take on water usage rights be tradable versus charging directly for water? Or is it the same thing?
Well, basically, if we go back to the Presidium and look at San Francisco and understand that when Mikhail Gorbachev brought himself to this continent and set himself up over there, he built what is now known as the Green Cross. So we've had the Red Cross, you know, they come running out at wartime and things like that. But we also have a Green Cross, and I'm looking at the Green Cross Optimist magazine published by the Green Cross Group. And I find an article here, I'll just share with a little bit of it from you. Mario Soros wrote this. Now, Mario Soros became the first civilian president of the Republic of Portugal in 1986 and so on and so forth. In 1998, Mario Soros launched the Global Water Contract Citizens Initiative with other parliamentarians and civil leaders. So we can think of that as a social contract. It's the Global Water Contract. And here are a couple of the words that he uses. The transfer of control over the world's water resources to such kings as Suez, RWE, Thames, Vivendi, and Bechtel through the privatization of service provision and Nestle, Coca-Cola, Danone, etc. through merchandising is becoming the order of the day. The oligarchy of financiers, technocrats, and tycoons should never be allowed to decide the destiny of life, for that is exactly what water is. And it drops down. The Water Manifesto, signed by many international partners and members of both European and national parliaments, the manifesto proclaims water to be an inalienable human right. And it continues, but what we basically are seeing in this particular edition of the magazine is this idea that the international community, that doesn't include you or I, those are the people that actually do meet at Davos, Switzerland, but the international community and Suez, for instance, as an international industrial and services group, these consultancies will come under control of all of the water on the planet, because neither you nor I are intelligent enough nor responsible enough, altruistic in our outlook or humanitarian in our nature, to be able to rightly deal with water. So it must be taken away from the sheeple and turned over to the hands of the great person or corporations established and controlled by them. This is intolerable. This is beyond belief. But this is the mindset of those that are behind Agenda 21 and the Green Cross.
So essentially, they're setting themselves up to do this public-private partnership situation with another resource. Correct?
Exactly. This will be another cartel just like OPEC, only, or the European coal and steel community. This will be another cartel in their minds, and it's well established. It's already all across the United States. There's a huge aquifer here in Missouri that I believe RWE Thames is controlling. But all of the water on the planet basically is a natural resource which can be used to capitalize the debt of the United States and all of the other countries that are involved in the International Monetary Fund, etc., where people have been basically duped into borrowing far more than they can ever pay back. And that's where the United States is today. It was a game that we invented and we took to the Southern Hemisphere, but it's a game that's now come home to roost. And so we just need to be aware of it, and people need to understand that we're not tasked here at this generation to wring our handkerchiefs over these poor polar bears that are doing the backstroke in the Arctic Ocean looking for an iceberg to climb onto. This is actually an agenda which is going to take away from all people, for all time, all of the natural resources of the planet, and we will simply be serfs on a global plantation. That's the short of it.
Let me add this, too, because I'm really into populism and grassroots. This bill does not have popular support at the grassroots level. As one example, the chief architect of this bill, although it was written, in my opinion, by an environmental organization, is Congressman Oberstar from represents the 8th District of Minnesota. There are more than 500 elected officials in Mr. Oberstar's district. That's legislators, county commissioners, township officials, city councilmen. Not one of them that we're aware of has publicly supported this bill. Not one. So this thing is not coming from the ground up. It's coming from wherever. And it's scary. And I don't know what's going to happen on Thursday. I don't think anybody does, but Barbara Boxer from California is determined to get this thing through a committee. Congressman Oberstar tried to get this thing. He didn't have the votes to get it through his own committee last year. Went to the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, tried to get an exception to get it to the House floor without approval from his own committee. My goodness, what is going on here?
Well, maybe perhaps, Don, we ought to think about what we can do, because we do have a deadline here. We have this coming up for a vote in committee on the Thursday. That's the day after tomorrow, the 18th, the reason for the season, the reason why we're here tonight at this late hour. And there are things that people can do if they're interested in expressing their displeasure. First, I would recommend that all that are out there listening tonight that have access to the Internet or can slide by a library, get a copy of this Senate Bill 787 and read it for yourselves. But then, if you would like to retain local control of your water, there are a variety of things that you can do. One of the things that you can do is to deluge your senators with calls and faxes and emails as quickly as you can, as much as you can, and let other people that you know that might be impacted by this to do the same. You can call area code 202, listeners. If you have a pencil and a paper handy, I'll give you a phone number. You can call area code 202-224-3121. Again, that's area code 202-224-3121, and that'll get you into the switchboard. Talk to your senator's staffers. Let them know that you would like them to get on top of this Senate Bill 787 and stop this Clean Water Restoration Act in committee and not allow it out of committee. And that would be one thing that you could do. Another thing that you could do would be to contact any of your local elected officials, let's say your legislator or your state senator, and express the same desire. You know, nowadays, as more and more states are passing these 10th Amendment resolutions, many more states are starting to think, wait a minute, wait a second. The federal government has taken too much power to themselves. This is a state issue. And so perhaps if we could have the state representatives and the state senators and the state governors and your local conservation department, your agricultural departments, your beef producers councils, have them get in touch with the Senate and let them know that this bill needs to die in committee on Thursday. Get on the telephone, folks. There are things that we can do to stop this. And additionally, the National Rifle Association has also bought onto this 787, and so perhaps you could call them, their office, the National Rifle Association, is area code 703-267-1000. Again, that's area code 703-267-1000. And talk to the person that answers the telephone there. Ask them the serious question, why is the National Rifle Association, the NRA, supporting Senate Bill 787? And would they please contact their Washington lobbyists and reverse this decision and not support Senate Bill 787? Now, this invokes, if you will, a very large populace, a large, strong voting bloc. And the more people that we can get to call in from all across America, whether it be from Salida, Colorado, or California, or wherever you're listening from tonight, every one of our calls is oftentimes referred to as a thousand of those that didn't call. So they really do multiply your calls by 1,000 when they think of how many people support or oppose the bill. So there are some things to do. Can you think of anything else, Don, that the listeners would be able to do?
No, I think you covered it, except I want to stress that Senator Boxer wants to mark up and pass this bill without a hearing. There has been no hearing on this bill. Last year, she held a hearing for 25 minutes on this bill back in, I believe it was in the spring. But there's been no hearing, and so I think people should demand a congressional hearing on this bill before any committee takes action on it.
One would even think that through the National Environmental Protection Act, or Policy Act, NEPA, one would even think that if you have such a piece of legislation such as this that would impact states, it would impact counties, that there should be a series of meetings going on, just like the USDA is having to do now with the listening posts on the National Animal Identification System. I don't see how they can even consider passing this out without a hearing, but certainly we, the people, should have a chance to chime in on this issue before it is passed.
So if this is a UN type of regulation, are people at the international level able to even have any say in this sort of thing?
Well, this is being done by Congress. I mean, we can speculate and we can make linkages and connect the dots with the UN, but our own Congress is going to do this, okay? And they need to be held accountable by the people that elected them and not report to a higher authority. So I would say, I don't know how to answer your question. Obviously, there's some influence there, heavy-duty influence coming from the UN folks. But we need to hold our elected congressmen and senators accountable on this thing. And I should say, too, that the Obama administration is given the green light to expand the jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, but this was brought up under...
And a lot of people said, former Senator Salazar from Colorado, kind of a conservative, pro-agriculture. He signed on to the letter. Well, you know what? He didn't really have a choice, in my opinion. He works for somebody.
Yeah, but this was brought up.
The Secretary of Agriculture and the President's Council, Chairman of the President's Council on Environmental Quality and Corps of Engineers. And so, it's a different political landscape. But the bill still stinks. It hasn't changed. And I think people... really need to rise up and say there's a better way, because there is a better way.
Right, but this did originate under Bush's administration, correct? Or did
it was introduced in three previous Congresses by Oberstar and also by Feingold last year. Now, Oberstar, it didn't really get to see the light of day because Oberstar was in the minority up until a couple of years ago. So it really only got traction after the after the 2006 election, and that's when the Rapanos decision came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. So it was in 2007 that this thing really got legs, and really had a Senate a Senate supporter, and of course Oberstar introduced it again. So, but and people said, well, so what if it passes Congress? Bush is going to veto it. I'm not sure he would have. I think he would have supported it. He blew it on the wetland stuff anyway.
We really need to understand this is not a partisan issue.
Right.
It was George Herbert Walker Bush that signed on to the Agenda 21 at Rio de Janeiro. It was William Jefferson Clinton that set up the first Agenda 21 President's Council with Albert Gore. It was George Herbert Walker Bush, or George Walker Bush, GW, who has done absolutely nothing to block any of this, and there can't be any more of a sustainable prince in power now. I like to call him Barry the Usurper, or the unqualified one. I don't believe that he's qualified to serve. We've never seen his birth certificate, but Barack Hussein Obama, there couldn't be any more of a left-leaning I want to be real careful with your audience, Melody, because no. I get a little bit particular on my broadcast about even giving this guy the time of day. But nevertheless, this is not a partisan issue. It's an international agenda. It's being implemented globally. You'll find the same sort of thing coming down in Europe. You'll find the same thing in South America. You'll see the same thing in Asia. It's just step by step by step. But the United States of America is ripe. We're a proving ground for this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, the developing nations who are supposed to be on the charitable end of this thing, all of these various initiatives, these global initiatives, we're the ones that have to take the brunt of it. We're the ones that get hit first, And so if folks would just take the time and study Agenda 21 carefully, you will find that in the developed nations, there are no weasel clauses. But in the developing nations, any nation that would be detrimentally impacted by these kind of initiatives get the pass. And so the burden is always falling on us, but they look at the women and the children and the indigenous people. If you get any of the publications, as I do, on a regular basis from the United Nations, you always see the African women in their native indigenous costume and things like that on the books. But really, it's not them. We're the focus, unfortunately.
Well, and you talk about people who haven't done anything to block it. There's certainly a few hundred million who haven't done anything for quite a while. You know, you hear a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of our listeners here, talking about that they don't know where to begin. They don't know what they can do. And what better way to start than something that really affects everybody you know, your future generations for sure. You know, you can really finally feel where it impacts you. It's not just something to do with people who, say, own 40 acres or more. You know, and maybe some of the Americans who are here can, you know, wake up, listen to some, you know, we have got a couple guests here tonight who, if most Americans followed at least half of what they're saying and were willing to do at least half of what they suggested in the last 20 minutes that normal Americans do, then we would not have to deal with many of the problems that are discussed on this radio show. So maybe we look to Bolivia here a little bit, see what they did with the Bechtel Corporation and what kind of, you know, really rabble rousing it takes, and that you gotta get active. And
well,
there's a lot of other work
we're
to
dealing
do.
With Shannon is that we've developed this. We've basically been inculcated from our births. Very, very few people out there in the listening audience tonight preceded the formation of UNESCO. Very few people in the listening audience tonight, my mother and father are now passed away. Very few people out there really go back to the time before this educational campaign came on us and at us. So almost everyone in the United States of America has been inculcated with this idea of worshiping the earth and environmentalism and Darwinism, evolution, and all of these various and sundry things that take us astray, all these various winds of doctrine. So it shouldn't be a surprise. The educational system, the media, the combined with the theater and all of that, it has just produced the most apathetic, milquetoast generation. Our ancestors would be absolutely outraged at our apathy. But when you mention Bolivia, or we think about Iceland, some of the other countries, Greece, whenever the jackboot of tyranny comes down on those people, they haven't had the cursing or the blessing of this kind of educational propaganda or propaganda, and they come out in the streets with their pitchforks and their torches, and they show their displeasure, and the French turn out and by the hundreds of thousands, you know. So we've come a long way, baby, but we haven't really come in the best direction. One of the things that the listeners could do this evening, if they're listening on the internet, or again, you could stop by the library. There's another website that you can go to, the American Land Rights website. It's www.landrights.org. So easy to remember, landrights.org. And if you go up on that internet website, you'll find all kinds of information that will help to guide you through this S-787 so that you'll understand not only what it is, but also what you can do and how important it is for you to act right away.
And I would add, too, you know, getting back to your point about participation in government, do something. You know, I'm confident that if you get the solution to the water quality issue or environmental issues in general down at the local, regional, and watershed level, you know, people are going to be forced to put up or shut up. You know, here's an opportunity. You only have to drive 50 miles to go to a meeting. You can make a phone call. You know, and because right now they feel like, well, you know, I hear all the time, they're going to do what they want, they being the federal government. And but if you get this down, we had tremendous participation in the Rivers Program. It was a success. There are those kinds of stories across the country, and I think they need to be told, and they need to be duplicated and expanded upon, because it really forces people to get involved or just get the heck out of the way.
Here in Southwest Missouri, Dawn and Melody and Shannon, we have the Ozarks Property Rights Congress, and basically what it is, it's a nonpartisan group. There really is even no membership. We don't even elect leadership, but we get together on a regular basis and have meetings, and we discuss all of the various and sundry things that are coming on us and at us that impact our property. Well, one of the young ladies that is associated with the group found out about the National Animal Identification System years ago. And she found that it was going to impact their family farm in a negative way, an adverse way. So she started doing her homework and her research. Well, just the other day, this past week, I think it was Wednesday, or no, it must have been last week on Wednesday, we had a series of these USDA National Animal Identification System listening posts, and hundreds and hundreds of people turned out in opposition. So it's not such a dim and bleak picture as perhaps I painted with the overall apathy. But it certainly requires an investment of our time and our interest in our future and our children's future. And we have turned this back in Missouri. Before that, there was a well monitoring and metering program that the state had passed legislation on. And this very same group got up in arms, if you will, got their dander up. And they stopped that, repealed that legislation, and took it out of Missouri. We're doing the same thing right now with the Real ID program. There are things we can do, but we must do something.
One of the things that I also would like to bring up is the fact that once this kind of legislation gets there and you have like a kind of an economy of scale that takes place, and your resource is going to go to the highest bidder. And when you have that situation takes place, we're going to be paying probably the highest amount for the water that the market can bear. And maybe even then some.
I can't imagine that we wouldn't have the inspectors for all of this put out to bid. You know, we've got the Blackwater Corporation, I think they're called ZU or something now, but we've got all these private contractors. There's Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root, Khaki, all of these various private contractors working to support the war effort in Iraq and Afghanistan and perhaps soon in Iran. All across America, we have this public-private partnership process going on, the privatization of government services. It's corporate. It's corporatism. I mean, you know, really, folks, Mussolini said it the best. You know, it's not fascism. It's corporatism. It's the public-private partnership. And what is that? What it basically boils down to, it is the clout or the financial wealth of corporations married to the force of government. So it wouldn't surprise me, Melody or Dawn or Shannon, if we wouldn't see something like this, an enforcement agency turned out to bid, and so we would then be subjected to the highest bidder and the way that they set up their corporation, their own rules, just like the IRS, just like the Federal Reserve. But they would be our water czars for the future.
Yeah, they're kind of passing out this czar thing a bit, aren't they?
Yeah, we're seeing czars already. I can't imagine if this bill passed, there'll be czars everywhere. Goodness.
Well, you know, if you think about it's so revealing, Don, because, you know, Melody, you hit on this. This is the same system that the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks brought in over in Russia when they took down the czars there. The whole idea behind Lenin and Stalin, the way that they ran their system, they had their 3-year plans, the 5-year plans, the 50-year plans, and so corporations follow the same Soviet model. We have the same Soviet structures all across America. These unelected, unappointed boards and councils are set up. So maybe there would be the Salida Regional Council on Clean Water. And those people would be appointed maybe by your county commissioners or perhaps by your regional council of government or something like that. They would be unelected. They would be perhaps 2, 4, 8-year terms. And you'll just basically go in and grovel at their feet, and they would set up whatever policies and programs and plans and things to implement this in their own best judgment, according to their own best practices and so on. Every time they make a mistake, you'd hear about lessons learned, you know. But this is America. This is the new Soviet America that we're moving into. And we're either going to do nothing and by our silence consent, or we'll just simply become Vocal Local, the name of my broadcast, and do something about it. We can say no to this globalist agenda as it transitions from global to local. We become Vocal Local. And we block the globalist agenda right where we are.
And even if we do manage to hold them back on this Senate Bill 787, this is going to keep coming back and coming back. That just seems to be the order of the day with the legislation that seems to come from this international level.
Well, this thing is not going to go away, especially in light of the two U.S. Supreme Court decisions that really put the brakes on expansion of federal authority under the Clean Water Act. So, and this hasn't even begun to hit the House yet. You know, the battle is now. It may come back again next year. It may get passed in some form this year. I don't really know. I would say because, you know, Colorado Congressman John Salazar is a major player in this on the House side. He was the leader of the conservative or moderate Democrats that stopped this thing in committee last year. So I would encourage people in Colorado.
Are you saying, in the district, to
contact him and say, hey, we don't need this. There's a better way.
Are you saying John Salazar or Ken Salazar? Because we've got two.
No, John.
Okay.
The congressman.
Okay.
He's on the Transportation Committee. And I believe he represents much of western Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah, John Salazar. I know Ken Salazar is now Secretary of Interior. Yeah. And really was forced to buy into this thing just because he's a cabinet-level official. So some people were surprised he signed the letter. I don't think he had a choice. But John Salazar is, in Colorado was very active in this issue last year, and I assume they will be this year. But let's be honest. I mean, we're going to need a lot of Democratic support. Our own Colin Peterson from Minnesota, the only Democrat there's a new Congressional Property Rights Caucus, and I think you're going to hear a lot more about property rights because they're getting violated all over the place. And I'm not talking about just private property rights, but the rights of recreationals to use and enjoy public lands and waters. I'm talking about rights of local government to do land use planning and basically, you know, keep this kind of stuff at the local level where you can deal with it in a sensible, common sense way. So I just think this stuff is, you're right, Melody, this stuff is going to keep coming back in one form or another. And there may be other legislation out there that will attempt to accomplish the same purpose if they don't get their way on this one.
Or slid in some other bill that we're not even
aware of. That's right. That's right. There was a watershed bill just exposed a couple of months ago. It's like, whoops, so what are they doing here? You know, it's kind of the same thing, but, you know, too many people are onto this one. Let's try something else. And, you know, the environmental lobby, which, like I said, is a multi-billion dollar industry, they keep relabeling things. You know, ecosystems management, smart growth, biodiversity, sustainable development. They, you know, it's the same stuff. You know, same agenda, different name. Let's call it something else and see if we can fool people once again. But there are enough people that you know, see through all the smoke screen.
Well,
there are enough people that want, you know, freedom and enjoy freedom and believe in states' rights and limited federal powers.
Well,
it's not like it used to be, but it's not gone.
Well, I think you could have best addressed this one about, you know, because there's a history to this environmental movement and how it ever started and who brought it about. And without understanding that, do you understand why we kind of pick on them a little bit?
And well, I understand why I pick on them. I bought into the agenda back in the 70s. I mean, I grew up in northern Minnesota. I mean, the Rainy River, which separates Minnesota and Canada, was a sewer. You know, Boise Cascade, a timber company, was dumping all kinds of crap in it. You know, driving through Gary, Indiana, where you couldn't see across the street. I mean, something really needed to be done. So many of us supported the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, but it didn't take long for those pieces of legislation to be used as a surrogate for control, for land use control and control of waters. And, you know, I couldn't believe that what government agencies were doing to people and communities in the name of environmental protection. And it's just gotten worse. And it's now really almost become a religion, or it has become a religion. And it's pretty scary stuff. And they're absolutely have become an industry in itself, supported by corporate foundations. In large part.
Okay, so you acknowledge that the CWA actually helped and that you were glad
that
that happened.
Oh, the Clean Water Act has, you know, I mean, I'm not going to speak to the economics. I'm not going to say
well, maybe you should a little.
That the money's been all well spent in all cases. I think there's been a lot of waste, but it's an enormous job, a cleanup. But what I'm saying is enormous progress has been made in both water and air quality.
It seems like
the Rainy River now, people, it's a wonderful fishery, and you know, people enjoy. They eat the fish out of there. There's nothing wrong with it. You drive through Gary, Indiana, and you can see across the street. So yeah, you know, some of these environmental bills have done, but that doesn't mean you just give the federal government more power. We're at the point now where it's kind of diminishing returns. That to try to clean up the little bit that's left is going to cost billions. It's going to cost more than cleaning up the first 99%. And that's kind of an axiom in pollution, in the pollution control business.
Okay, so say
it becomes economically prohibitive to go much further.
All right, let's imagine someone has just tuned into the program in the last few minutes, and we acknowledge we're talking about Senate Bill 787, and we're wanting this bill not to get passed and give expansive powers to the federal government, but that the CWA, the Clean Water Act, is something that has done good things. Say we succeed with that. What, you know, if someone's on the edge out there saying, okay, say I don't want expanded federal government powers just for the principle of that, what is the solution for these water issues in a local sense?
Well, I think if I can just kind of reiterate what I said earlier in the program is I think without an alternative, you know, we're lost. I think the alternative is to look at different landscapes across the country and tailor programs that have broad support among local and regional folks. That can be done through formal joint powers agreements among counties, other local units of government. It can be done by legislatures. In the case, we replaced the federal rivers program with one supported by the state legislature, carried out by local elected officials. Very successful. Got people involved in government. People felt they were participating in a meaningful way. That can happen in this case, too. If you get this thing down to the local level, and have a government and environmental objectives reached through local grassroots support, rather than the top-down centralization, which is what this bill is all about, consolidating and expanding power in Washington.
One of the other things that the public needs to also be aware of while this is going on, they're chipping away bit by bit at each one of our constitutional rights and between the air, land, and water. I mean, little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit somewhere else, and before we know it, we don't have any land left.
You're
to
so
live
polite.
In.
Isn't it a lot here and a lot there?
This one is a lot. This one is the big kahuna. It really is. Let me just interject something. This has been a passion issue of mine. I was the 20-something liberal in the 70s, but I had a professor at George Washington who said, hey, you know, you guys, wait until they get around to controlling non-point source pollution. There's going to be a revolution when that happens. That's what this bill is all about.
So that was already on the books and in their minds and set up back when he was talking about it.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know it. I was too young and naive.
Well, you know, the federal
now
reserve
I get
already
it.
Existed.
I, you know, now I get it.
I think one of the places that we really need to start in this thing for anyone that has just tuned in is to understand, first of all, the relationship between people and private property, privately owned, privately held property. The difference between private property and private land and public land and public domain and jurisdictions, and then think of it, your private property as being something that is unlike anywhere else on the planet. When we set up this country, when our founding fathers set it was set up such that we could have equality of opportunity as opposed to equalities of outcome. But in the last 100 years, we've made this great transference. And so much of what all of this is about is changing our principles, our American principles, our American values, and our American lifestyles into this new global cooperative, if you will, this collective, the greatest good of the greatest number. We've got three E's in sustainable development to understand: environment and equity and economy. And when we think about Agenda 21, this great tome that came out of Rio de Janeiro, we're talking about environmental, we're sustaining environmental and developmental concerns, but a concern has always been understood, at least for in academia, as a corporation. So we're sustaining, we're propping up, or we're shoring up environmental and developmental concerns. And again, we're not talking about the fish in the water. We're not talking about the polar bears in the sea. We're talking about these certain kinds of corporations. There's now talk all through the media about this new green building movement, you know. And so we have the environment. Certainly, we don't want to poison ourselves off. But again, it goes back to who's polluting and who's polluting where and what is this pollution, and then dealing with that intelligently and reasonably right where you are, right there, deal with that. And then there's the economy. Who's going to pay for this enormous army of inspectors, detectors, and selectors? Don't you have a private property interest in your land? Do you want someone actually coming along in a white truck or a van, coming out onto your property and looking at your farm pond, for instance, or establishing some kind of control over a wet spot in your lawn? So you've got the economy. There's huge economy that's on there. And then we've got this idea of equity. You know, back in England, when we had the common law, then they raised up this court of chancery, the chancery courts. You pay your fee, you take your chance. That was like your get-out-of-jail-free court by the priest lawyers, if you will. And so we've got this equity coming on us, where basically, if you pay your fee and you take your chance and your name is Dow, or your name is Monsanto, or Kellogg Brown and Root, then you get the pass. But the rest of us just get the shaft. And so we want to be very careful about going down these kinds of roads. And so with this particular bill, S-787, if we can stop it in committee, we will stop it. And then we'll have to go back, and yes, we'll have to look at this gold mining firm that polluted a river here. We'll have to go over and talk to General Electric. We'll have to go talk to Dow Chemical and Monsanto. But you know, these senators aren't going to do that. And so if they're not going to do it now, what makes us think that they're going to do it after this legislation is passed? They won't. The lobbyists will block it. And so they're going to continue to get the pass. We'll continue to get the shaft.
And if I could add to what William said on the property rights, I think this is really important, and that is the courts haven't been real kind. They have really not respected property rights with respect to regulatory taking. In other words, you know, for example, in the Lucas case in 1989, I believe it was, you know, the Supreme Court found that the government, the Coastal Commission of South Carolina, had taken 100% of the value of Lucas's property, and therefore the government had to reimburse them for all of that. But if it's less than that, if they take the 90% through regulation, the government doesn't own them a cent. And that doesn't make sense. I mean, we hear a lot about, like, the Kelo decision, the abuses of eminent domain, and certainly that has gone on. But I think the biggest fear with respect to violating private property rights is the regulatory takings, where the government basically takes all of your almost all of the value of your land without paying you a penny. And that is certainly, in principle, a violation of the Fifth Amendment, which talks about just compensation. If land is to be used, taken for a public purpose, which certainly environmental objectives is a public purpose. And the whole intent is to have the public pay for that.
Yeah,
so I think that's really an important point in terms of understanding property rights and the problems that we're having in the courts.
One of the
sorting
things,
that out so that it's fair.
One of the things that we have to be also aware of is how when these situations take place, how they kind of spin out of control, and where they may take one of these little rights, and all of a sudden they, you know, they're blending it in with so many other avenues. Before you know it, we don't have any recourse on this sort of thing once it gets started. And just to bring it back home to us a little bit, even though it seems innocuous that they may be trucking water out of the area, can you imagine what happens if they start trucking it not only out of the area but out of country? And you have all these foreign corporations coming in and who will want maybe the water to be in their domain because they have the money, and we don't, you know.
Yes, we've heard so many times, Melody, you know, when I read these United Nations publications, you know, we wring our handkerchiefs about the poor young girls in Afghanistan that can't go to school because they have to spend all day carrying water. You know, we hear the same story all throughout from Africa. We hear the same story from every place that's too far away from any of us to be able to go and check it out ourselves. But this is the mantra. This is where we're going, and you're absolutely right. Once we start going down this slippery slope and we give away, and Don is so correct, you know, this is a taking. This Senate Bill 787 has, you know, eminent domain stamped all over it. When one of these eco-Nazis, I like to call them, these baggy little things that come in and are looking for wetland plants and things like that on your property, once these eco-Nazis come in, and I used to work in the development business, and I've had major projects halted and major expenses incurred, major losses, and projects actually lost on account of some little wetland this or wetland that, you know, completely insignificant in perspective. But when they come in, basically, they transform the ownership of the land. Now, all of a sudden, they claim jurisdiction over these plants, over a farm pond. And believe me, I had a very large subdivision that was stopped on a farm where the farmer had actually built a pond and watered his stock in it for years. And then as he was retiring, he decided to develop this land with his children. And because he had built this pond, the pond had to remain. But the way that the development plan worked out and the way that the lay of the land worked out, I needed that particular place where the pond was to build a cul-de-sac. And it held up the entire project. We had to redesign it. Couldn't get anywhere near as much land usage out of it. And so it defeated a lot of the purposes that they had in mind. But this was a man-made pond, not a natural pond. So all of these impoundments and all of this stuff, when we add it all together, this is so much that we just cannot continue to go down this route. The ecology is not even a science. It's just an opinion. And so there is an environment. There is degradation, certainly. But let's keep it local. Let's keep the federal government out of it. Let's keep the United Nations out of it. And let's keep these international and transnational corporations out of our hair. And we can easily do that just by saying no to Senate Bill 787.
You know, well, that's one thing I really like about you. You really can get into the nitty-gritty on the background, and I'd like you to hear a little bit more about what your program involves, and same with you, Don.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So, Will, do you want to reiterate a little bit of what
sure.
you cover?
Sure, I will.
Well,
and Don, why don't you go first and tell us about the AmericanPropertyCoalition.org.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were set up primarily to kill this bill and substitute a local and regional alternatives. And now we have, working with American Land Rights Alliance, a group that's actually a PAC called the National Water and Conservation Alliance, set up strictly to kill this bill in favor of local and regional alternatives. And so we're tracking this thing very closely. We're sending out hundreds of thousands of emails because it's really the only recourse we have. We do not have any support to speak of in the print media. Thank goodness for talk radio, like your shows. And that's one way to get the word out. So, and this thing is apparently going to be marked up with an attempt to pass it on Thursday in the Senate. And the Senate Environment Public Works Committee, people should call their senators and tell them to vote no on this thing.
And my broadcast is titled Become Vocal Local. You can hear it Monday through Friday on both the Oracle Broadcasting Network and on Revolution Broadcasting. It's oraclebroadcasting.com, and that runs from 9 o'clock a.m. Central Time until 11, and again back at noon, from noon until 1 o'clock Central Time on Revolution Broadcasting. And basically the idea of becoming vocal local is to do just precisely that. We study all of the things about local government, how the political party structure doesn't work but is intended to work. We look at all of the places where we, the people, can interact effectively and block these global agendas right where we are. But we'll also take a look on this broadcast of what has gone wrong in this system and what could be right about it, and then try and advance solutions on a daily basis, salted in with some good news and workable solutions.
Well, you know, I really do appreciate both of you guys coming on, staying up late to inform us. Because I mean, I really want to mention this. I found when I started doing radio, which I had no background in it, but I saw a need for getting information out, and I found out in the community around this country, there's a lot of people that dedicate a lot of time for nothing. Or even at their own expense. So, because, you know, we really do want to preserve the country that we have had. And I've found very much that Will, with his program, has been very dedicated to educating the people with his vast knowledge and book knowledge as well. And so I really want to thank you, Don and Will and Shannon. And next week we're going to have Andrew Johnson on. And so I want to thank you again.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Night.